Okay. So on Thursday, August 14, 1980, workers in the giant Lenin shipyard in Gdansk downed tools and started an occupation strike. The strike was triggered by the sacking of Anna Valentinovits, a 50-year-old crane driver and militant with the group Coastal Worker. Her comrades called on their colleagues to stop work, and by mid-morning, a mass meeting of workers had gathered to argue with the manager, who was trying to address them from an abandoned bulldozer. Just then, Lech Wałęsa, another Coastal Worker militant who had also been sacked by management, scaled the shipyard fence and climbed up onto the bulldozer next to the harried manager. He announced himself to the crowd and declared the start of an occupation strike. News of the strike spread and workers across the region downed their tools in solidarity with the Lenin workers, bringing the whole city to a standstill. By Saturday, just 3 days since the start of the strike, all the Lenin workers' demands had been met, including the reinstatement of Valentinovits and Wałęsa. Over the shipyard's PA system, Wałęsa announced the victory and called an end to the strike. But the other workplaces on strike hadn't won anything. A delegate from the tram drivers angrily accosted Wałęsa, demanding that they stay out until the other workplaces win their demands too. Workers were starting to stream out of the gates of the Lenin shipyard, so Wałęsa and Valentinovits ran towards them, urging them to go back. A bunch of workers were convinced to stay, and the occupation resumed. Over the weekend, workers began to set up new organisations to coordinate the strike across workplaces. The Inter-Enterprise Strike Committee, or MKZ, to use the Polish acronym, was formed. Delegates from each workplace strike committee were elected to the MKZ to represent their colleagues in negotiations. This body formulated a new set of 21 demands, which covered a broad range of social and political issues. The list began with a demand for free, independent trade unions, significant in a country where all civil institutions were tightly controlled by the regime. It went on to call for a relaxation of censorship, new rights for the church, freeing of political prisoners, improvements to the health service, funding for pensions, and access to childcare for working mothers. The MKZ was an intensely democratic body. Negotiations with the party were even broadcast over the shipyard PA system so all the workers could listen in, keeping their representatives accountable. By the end of August, the regime had signed the 21 demands in Gdansk. This was a huge victory for the working class. Soon, MKZ started popping up all over the country in city after city. 3 weeks after the Gdansk agreement, delegates from MKZs all across Poland met up at their first national meeting. At this meeting, delegates voted to form a unified national organisation which they called the Independent Self-Governing Union Solidarity, or Solidarność in Polish. With this, one of the greatest revolutionary workers' movements in the 20th century was born. Yet just 16 months later, the revolution was smashed by the Polish military. Solidarność was outlawed, its leaders imprisoned, and martial law imposed on the population. So how was one of the most organised and powerful workers' movements defeated by the weak Polish regime? And importantly, what lessons can socialists learn from this experience? There are three things I hope you take away from this talk on Solidarność. The first is that this revolutionary workers' movement exposed the fact that Poland, similar to all of the Eastern Bloc countries, was not actually socialist, but it was deeply class divided, just like Western capitalist countries. The ruling class, which was embodied by the one-party state, owned and controlled production in order to compete with the West, and they increased their wealth by exploiting the mass of the working population who had absolutely no democratic input into how society was run. The second thing I want to argue is that the Polish working class had the potential to overthrow that regime. By forming Solidarność, they created the organisational basis of what could have been a new workers' state, one that could eliminate class divisions and run society collectively and democratically. And finally, I want to offer a Marxist explanation for why, despite its incredible potential, Solidarność was defeated. As I unpack the key events of 1980 to 1981, I'll show how it was the reformist leadership of Solidarność and their commitment to self-limitation that led the revolutionary uprising to its tragic defeat. What was missing was a leadership inside Solidarność with revolutionary socialist politics that could push the workers to smash the state and take power for themselves. So let's start with a bit of background to the revolution. The Gdansk strikes didn't come out of nowhere. In 1980, Poland was in the throes of its worst economic crisis since the end of World War II. Poland's rulers had racked up huge debts to Western lenders to build massive factories, and they were now unable to complete them. The regime tried to pay off some of this debt by exporting raw materials, food, and fuel, which were all desperately needed for domestic consumption. This created shortages, so local factory directors started hoarding goods, which further exacerbated the problem. As a result, the black market exploded. Increasingly getting access to essential goods meant waiting for hours in bread lines, having connections, or just plain corruption. So Lenin describes the necessary conditions for a revolutionary situation. Firstly, the ruling class can no longer rule in the old way. The party in Poland was unable to resolve the economic crisis and was making decisions that were exacerbating the problem. Secondly, the masses no longer accept being ruled over as before. Polish workers began to protest and strike against their falling living standards and express their anger at what appeared to be economic mismanagement by the regime. And finally, there is a spark which triggers the revolution. In Poland, the spark occurred when the party tried to raise the price of meat. For the masses, this was the straw that broke the camel's back. In 1980, the regime tried to move meat into commercial stores where prices weren't fixed by the government. This effectively raised the price of meat and it triggered a massive strike wave. The party tried to subdue this, and what they did was they awarded striking workers a pay rise, but not workers who weren't on strike, which is kind of like proving the point of the effectiveness of a strike. And it actually had the opposite effect of drawing more workers into strikes. And workers began raising a slogan, which was, "Those who do not strike do not eat meat," which is a pretty cheeky take on the Stalinist slogan, "Those who do not work do not eat." The wave of struggle culminated in Gdansk shipyard strike in August and the formation of Solidarność. Okay, the months following the signing of the Gdansk Agreement saw a rising tide of struggle and self-organisation by workers to guarantee that that agreement was enforced. Far from ending battles between workers and the regime, the Gdansk Agreement just opened the door to a flood of popular demands and sharp regional and national conflicts. During this time, the full potential power of Solidarność was on display. Every time the regime tried to renege on the agreement, it was met with strikes and protests by workers. In the autumn, two Solidarność members were arrested for leaking a document revealing the regime had no intention of actually meeting the demand for freedom of expression, which they'd agreed to at Gdansk. In fact, they had a plan for using the security police to deal with dissidents. Workers responded immediately by going on strike to demand the release of prisoners and for safeguards against police harassment, including defunding the police and punishment for those responsible for police brutality. The Warsaw branch of Solidarność threatened a general strike in the region if the demands weren't met. And within 24 hours, the prisoners were released. But in this experience, workers had learnt that if any concessions were actually going to be extracted from the regime, that they would need to fight for it. Struggle is the best educator. By participating in revolutionary struggle, workers learn that collectively they have the power to shape society in their own interests. The more the Polish working class thwarted the regime's attempts to undermine the agreement, the more confidence workers developed in their own collective ability. Demands became more radical and workers began taking reforms into their own hands. For example, workers were determined to root out corruption and the misuse of public offices. So in Gdansk, workers set up a committee to inspect cheating and corruption in the rationing system, and they found heaps. Workers in other parts of the country started to take over buildings that had previously been used for private functions and turn them into socially useful things, such as health clinics, schools, or nurseries. Solidarność also demonstrated how the organised working class in revolutionary moments can lead the struggle for the liberation of all of the oppressed. The example that was set by workers led to an explosion of independent, self-governing organisations in all walks of life. Students established and won recognition for their own union called Student Solidarity. Peasants, which had been neglected and taken for granted by the regime, developed their own set of demands and formed a rural solidarity network. Even prisoners had started to organise around a series of demands to improve their own conditions. A feminist group was set up in Warsaw demanding equal pay for women and reached out to Solidarność to discuss the need to challenge backwards attitudes to women in society. Even in breadlines, they started to form their own self-governing committees to coordinate placeholding for children and the elderly so they didn't have to stand in line for hours. Solidarność was showing in practice that the working class has the capacity to run society collectively and democratically in the interest of the majority. In just a few short months, through their power at the point of production, workers had begun reorganising the Polish economy to prioritise the needs of the people, not the profits of the ruling elite. The clashes between Solidarność and the state came to a head in March 1981. In the city of Bydgoszcz, workers had been occupying an office in support of the peasants' campaign for formal recognition of rural solidarity. The regime had been holding out on this. When Solidarność representatives went to the local prefecture to negotiate with party representatives, they were ambushed by hundreds of police who beat them up and threw them all in jail. In response, 500,000 workers in the Bydgoszcz region just erupted into strike. A delegates meeting decided to hold a nationwide four-hour stoppage on the 27th of March and then declared that after that, if the regime hadn't met their demands, they would only have 4 days to do so before workers went on strike indefinitely. The demands that they called for included punishment of those responsible for the Bydgoszcz beatings, recognition of rural solidarity, the release of political prisoners, and full pay for the workers on strike. The four-hour stoppage was observed completely by the workers. Even the party's 1 million working-class members went on strike as well, just showing how united the force of Solidarność was. Workers set about preparing for the indefinite strike by designating the biggest factories across the country as strike headquarters. They readied them with fortifications, food and sleeping bags. And all of society seemed to be standing behind the workers. A young woman from Warsaw Solidarność described the mood in that moment like this. She said, "Scouts came in with flowers for us, old men with ration cards for sausages, old ladies with cold drinks, jam and blankets. The whole country was like a coiled spring. We were ready for them to do their worst. The spirit was incredible and the people were 120% behind us." In the face of a people united against them, the regime wavered. Defence Minister General Wojciech Jaruzelski was not sure that they could win a confrontation, even by mobilising large numbers of the police and threatening to bring in the Russians. So instead, he appealed to the Solidarność leadership to negotiate and call off the strike. Outrageously, Wałęsa and a team of advisers went behind the backs of the workers and even the other delegates to negotiate in secret with Jaruzelski. Wałęsa then unilaterally called off the strike on national TV, without even all of the demands being met, saying that the risk of violence was too high. This led to confusion, anger and bitterness amongst Solidarność members. Those hospitalised during the Bydgoszcz attacks denounced the decision from their hospital beds. But despite the opposition from Solidarność's rank, the strike was aborted. After this, Solidarność was never as united and confident as it had been before Bydgoszcz. But Wałęsa's actions weren't just a matter of cold feet, though. It had to do with the influence of reformism in Solidarność's leadership. Wałęsa and those around him thought that Solidarność could resolve the class struggle through a joint partnership with the party. This reformist strategy came from a group of unelected advisers to the leadership that were drawn from the Warsaw intelligentsia. The most influential of these advisers were from a dissident group called KOR, which had been openly fighting for democratic rights against the party and agitating amongst workers in the lead up to the revolution, and agitating in particular for free independent unions. KOR was the organisation that set up Coastal Worker, the group that Wałęsa and Valentinowicz were members of. So these advisers had credibility as activists. The advisors shared with the workers a desire to fight for democratic freedoms and see change in how Poland was run, but they weren't socialists. They supported the right of workers to form unions and for these unions to influence economic decisions to an extent, but they were against any political challenges to the ruling party, let alone smashing the state and replacing it with workers' power. From the advisors' perspective, the goal of Solidarno should be limited to it acting in partnership with the party to implement economic reforms in Poland, something similar to the role of a Western trade union movement. And their watchword for this strategy was self-limitation. That's explicitly how they outlined this strategy. It was on their advice that the leadership accept the formula of the leading role of the party in Poland. This formula was essentially a commitment not to challenge the capitalist state and just to keep the movement within their reformist framework. And it explains why they held the class back from starting an indefinite general strike after the Bydgoszcz affair. But despite the advisors' strategy of self-limitation, the months leading up to the Bydgoszcz affair showed plainly that Solidarno went beyond the scope of a traditional trade union. It was really the embryo of a workers' state. Unlike traditional unions which fight over wages or conditions within one workplace or industry, Solidarno united the entire working class. It was a truly mass workers' organisation. By November in 1981, Solidarno had 10 million members, which was about 80% of the entire Polish working class. One of its boldest demands was to reduce wage differentials in order to cut across the old divisions between skilled and unskilled workers. It spoke to all of the workers, from industrial plants to shops, from cafes to government offices. The MKZs were organised through elected delegates from every corner of the economy. They looked less like unions and more like the Soviets or workers' councils of the Russian Revolution. These were revolutionary organs of workers' power, democratic, workplace-based, and built to challenge the rule of the bosses entirely. What existed in Poland was actually a situation that socialists call dual power. This develops in revolutions when two great forces, the organised, united, and confident working class on the one hand, and the old ruling class on the other, where those two forces stand opposed to one another in a battle for how society should be organised and in whose interests. As far as the ruling class was concerned, there was no question of compromise with Solidarno. They couldn't restabilise society in their favour without smashing the workers' movement. The economic crisis was going from bad to worse, and any resolution acceptable to the regime would require the redisciplining and resubordination of the working class. Solidarno would have to be smashed to achieve political and economic stability in the interests of the Polish ruling class. On the side of Solidarno, if the workers were going to fully realise their aspirations for a society run for human need, then the existing state would have to be pushed aside and replaced with a new one based on the democratic structures of Solidarno. The logic of this situation was that one side must destroy the other. The last 8 months of Solidarno represented the battle of which side would succeed. But the reformist leadership did not understand this, believing that they could come to some kind of compromise with the party. The tragedy of Poland was that the workers' side never developed the political clarity and organisation needed to smash their class enemy, while Poland's rulers did. For months after the Bydgoszcz affair, there were no significant strikes. This bought the ruling class time to regroup and look for a force capable of putting down Solidarno. And they found this in the military. Unlike the rest of the state, the military retained a high level of esteem from the population. Not being responsible for managing a collapsing economy and not going through the turmoil of strikes against their officers meant that cohesion in the armed forces remained relatively intact. People believed the army could never fire on its own people and would act as a bulwark against Russian invasion. And it also didn't help that the Solidarno leadership didn't try to seize on opportunities to split the army when they arose and develop class consciousness within the rank and file soldiers. But I'll talk more about that a bit later. The ruling class gradually shifted power over to the military. In October 1981, General Jaruzelski, who was by this point already the Prime Minister and the Minister of Defence, replaced Stanislav Kania as Party First Secretary, giving him unilateral decision-making power over the state. He immediately extended duty for conscripts, due to be demobbed, by 2 extra months, and this was clearly a sign the military was preparing for battle with Solidarnosc. Bit by bit, the army started to assume a role in civil administration. Solidarnosc's leadership failed to see the significance of these moves. When Jaruzelski was appointed Party First Secretary, Wałęsa said that this concentration of power was actually a good thing because it meant that Solidarnosc would only have to negotiate with one guy. But even with these concerning developments, Solidarnosc's defeat in December was not a foregone conclusion. The deepening economic crisis actually led to an uptick in strikes and hunger marches across the country. Food shortages were becoming really critical at this point as well. By September 1981, 2/3 of Poland's provinces were affected by significant strikes. However, the leadership held fast to its commitment to self-limitation. Wałęsa went around discouraging the strikes, demanding restraint so he could continue with his farcical negotiations with the regime. Without leadership to encourage, connect, and generalise the struggle towards taking power, the upsurges from below remained fragmented, incoherent, and isolated from one another. So from mid-November, the strike wave sadly started to die down. The membership had become exhausted and was increasingly turning away from Solidarnosc in disappointment. In early December, a student occupation of the firefighters' school in Warsaw was brutally ejected by the police. Jaruzelski announced he was going to ask Parliament for emergency powers to ban strikes altogether. This signalled the start of what was clearly a military intervention to put down the workers' movement. By now it had become clear, even to the moderate Solidarnosc leaders, that the regime was just giving them the runaround, using negotiations to stall so it could get its act together and smash the workers' movement. Finally, the leaders began preparations for a confrontation with the state, planning a general strike and demanding a provisional government to pave way for free elections. But this turnaround was too late in the game. Momentum is key in revolution. Militant strikes aren't something that can just be turned on and off like a tap at the whim of directions from the leadership. After months of acting as firefighters, holding back militant action taken by the rank and file, the exhaustion and demoralisation that had set in amongst the masses was terminal. The final blow to Solidarnosc came when the leaders met in Gdansk on December 12th to plan the strike. That night, while they slept, riot police surrounded their hotel, arrested and interned them all. On December 13, Jaruzelski announced martial law and outlawed solidarity. So could it have been different? There are various explanations offered about why Solidarnosc went down to defeat. Some argue it was doomed to failure from the start because of the threat of Russian tanks. Others argue that Solidarnosc was too radical, that it went too far too fast and provoked the military. Actually, the movement didn't go far enough, and it was due to its reformist leadership, which refused to argue for Solidarnosc to challenge the regime for political power. What was needed was a revolutionary socialist party rooted in Solidarnosc that could win workers over to just such an argument. Concretely, this would have involved arguing to win as broad a section of workers, soldiers, peasants, students, all of the oppressed as possible, to the idea that the entire state had to be smashed and replaced with workers' power, and that included the military. This would have meant intervening to split the military along class lines. Half the soldiers in the army were conscripts, and many of them would have been Solidarnosc members before they were enlisted. But despite this, the Solidarnosc leadership did not use its power to fight for conscripts when Jaruzelski announced a 2-month extension on their military service, even though soldiers actually appealed to Solidarnosc to fight this. Organising the rank and file of the armed forces would have seriously undermined the regime's ability to regroup and strengthen Solidarnosc's position in the struggle for state power. Socialists would have had to make the argument to Solidarnosc's members that the capitalist state needed to be smashed and that joint partnership with the party to reform Poland was a pipe dream. but only through assuming state power themselves through Solidarnosc, could workers take democratic control of production and achieve their aims. The reformists argue that challenging state power could have provoked Russian intervention, just like in Hungary and Czechoslovakia in previous decades. But in one sense, this is kind of a moot point because it was the Polish military that put down Solidarnosc in the end. They didn't even need Russian tanks. But regardless, the movement could have overcome this threat. The situation in the Eastern Bloc was very different in 1980. Firstly, the USSR was bogged down in a messy war in Afghanistan, which was a significant strain on its military resources, so it was less likely to send troops into Poland. Secondly, if Solidarnosc had split the military and won soldiers to their side, they could have formed quite effective armed workers' defences. Poland had the second largest military in the Warsaw Pact, so this would have been a serious barrier to foreign intervention. And finally, and I think this is the most important point, the revolution could have spread to other Eastern Bloc countries. The same conditions of repression and economic crisis were being felt across the East. So workers there had very similar interests in fighting the Soviet-aligned regimes in their own countries. If workers took power in Poland, they could have encouraged these struggles and offered them support. A regional revolution would have been impossible for the Soviet leaders to put down. So just to start to conclude, the rise and fall of Solidarnosc stands as one of the most powerful examples of working class strength in modern history. In just over a year, Polish workers built a mass movement that challenged the very foundations of the regime and showed that ordinary people can organise to run society for themselves. But the tragedy is that this revolutionary potential was held back by a leadership committed to compromise. Instead of pushing forward to overthrow the state, they clung to the illusion of partnership with the ruling class, even as that class prepared to crush them. I want to end on this artwork. I'm actually not sure where it's from, but I just think it's a really beautiful representation of workers' struggle. Revolution is the heartbeat of socialism. Each heartbeat on this artwork corresponds to a moment that Polish workers rose up against their repressive rulers. From fighting the Nazis in 1944 to the Solidarnosc movement in the 1980s. The workers who formed Solidarnosc built on the lessons that they learnt from these previous struggles. And the hope is that the lessons of the experiences of 1980 to 1981 will be learnt for the next time round of struggle. And I think that that lesson is not that Solidarnosc went too far, but that it didn't go far enough. A revolutionary movement needs a revolutionary strategy. It needs leaders rooted in the working class, clear about the need to smash the capitalist state and replace it with workers' power. For socialists today, the task is to prepare for future uprisings by building that kind of leadership now so that next time we don't just rise up, but we win.